So I'm Katarina Linos, and it's my pleasure to introduce today's speaker, Elisa Massimino. So she is the president and CEO of Human Rights First, one of the leading advocacy bodies in this country. She joined Human Rights First in 1991 as a staff attorney, then worked for over a decade as the organization's Washington director, and today leads Human Rights First. She worked as a litigator before joining Human Rights First, and in her work accomplished a lot of pro bono litigation. Now, as a national authority on human rights issues, she's testified over a dozen times before Congress on human rights issues, and she serves as a frequent commentator in the national print media, as well as on radio and television. But in ending this introduction, let me mention a particular accomplishment. She's the daughter of a nuclear submarine commander, and she was thus able to bring together retired generals and admirals to speak about our government's policies on the torture of prisoners in U.S. custody. This coalition of military leaders was instrumental in changing those policies and in getting our country to comply with our obligations under the Geneva Conventions. Most recently, there was a major Senate Intelligence Committee report on what the CIA was doing and how those interrogation and detention practices should change, and Elisa was critical in bringing about this change. Please join me in welcoming her here today. So I'll start with a few questions, and then I look forward to your questions. Elisa, why don't you tell us a little bit about Human Rights First?
Sure. Well, first of all, I want to say thank you all for being here, and many thanks to the World Affairs Council for hosting this event. And it's great to be here in San Francisco. Human Rights First, I would encourage all of you to check our website if you are interested, if your interest is piqued on this or other issues. As Katarina said, we work on a range of issues, including national security. But our mission really is to challenge the United States to be a global leader on human rights. We don't have offices, Human Rights First, in other countries. We're an American organization, and we really embrace that as our mission, to ensure that our own country lives up to its ideals and its foreign policy, and also, in many instances, in its domestic policy, that it can lead by example, hence so much of our work on the national security front. So we work on a range of different issues that we believe require American leadership. So whether it's supporting human rights defenders in other countries who are really fighting on the front lines of social change in their own countries, this topic that we're going to discuss tonight, the rise of extremism and the manifestation in anti-Semitic hate crime in Europe. We're also paying special attention to the rights of refugees fleeing persecution all over the world, and then in particular the situation of asylum seekers, refugees who are seeking safe haven in this country. Human Rights First operates one of the largest and most successful pro bono asylum representation projects in the country, where we leverage the resources and legal talents of the private bar to the tune of about $40 million a year. We get lawyers in private practice to represent asylum seekers from about 85 different countries, and we do that in our three offices in New York, in Washington, where I live, and in Houston. We opened a new office in Houston last year. So we work on many, many other issues as well. I noticed, I don't know if all of you had a chance to see these amazing photographs in the lobby, in the hallways here, on the plight of victims of modern-day slavery, human trafficking. It's another issue that Human Rights First has taken up, looking at it really as how can we disrupt the profit-making enterprise of modern-day slavery, looking at the business model that fuels this horrible human rights violation. So one of many different issues that we're working on right now, but if you want to know more about us, it's humanrightsfirst.org.
Great. Thank you for that introduction.
Sure.
Let's get to today's conversation topic, the rise of far-right extremism in Europe. What's been happening? What has changed recently?
Well, that's a big open question, and I'll try to have a short response. Obviously, in every society, there is extremist forces of some kind or another, including in our own. But they have gotten disturbing traction in some European countries lately, and Europe's history makes that even more disturbing. Anti-Semitism, xenophobia, anti-Muslim bigotry, these kind of hatreds never really disappear. But they increase and decrease depending on human rights conditions and other socio-political factors. You know, there's no question that the financial crash has been one of those contributing factors. It has led to divisions that ultra-nationalist and neo-fascist parties tend to exploit. Devastating poverty and unemployment has made it easier for far-right parties to sell their xenophobic and racist proposals. But it's important to note that it's, you know, there's not a direct correlation between the financial situation and the rise of these ultra-nationalists and hate parties. You know, there are, so it's not always the case that you know, poor economic situations result in a surge of racist parties or popularity of racist parties. So that means that there's something else at play. And one of the things that we're finding is the actions and the you know, public remarks of government officials really makes a difference. So I'm going to talk a little bit about specific governments later, but it's really clear to us that when extremism is indulged, it increases, and when it's challenged, it decreases. You know, more broadly, I would say that most European governments really have not done a very good job of integrating and helping their immigrant populations. The presence of entrenched and isolated and often poor and Muslim immigrant populations, as well as in some countries, disenfranchised Roma communities, that has really played into the hands of the far-right extremists. Hostility to Roma, to immigrants, to Muslims, that unites all the far-right parties in Europe. There are some, like the Golden Dawn Party in Greece we're going to talk about, that are proudly anti-Semitic. Others, like the National Front in France, has tried to play down its anti-Semitism, particularly recently. And the Freedom Party in the Netherlands is actually at least nominally pro-Jewish. One thing this tells you about some far-right parties is that they are getting more media savvy. And that is also a reason, I think, why they've made some advances. There's a limit, even in the worst of these situations, to how much support an openly racist and anti-Semitic party can get, can garner. So some of the parties are cloaking their nationalism in, different garb these days, and they're framing their racist and xenophobic message as, you know, kind of common sense immigration proposals and that kind of thing. So it's hard to track this. But, you know, I guess the last factor that I want to mention in terms of that has contributed, I think, to the rise of popularity in some of these parties is that the far right is anti-EU, and it benefits from a broader Euroscepticism, which is present even, obviously, in a broader swath of society in many of these countries than is the racist, xenophobic, anti-Semitic sentiment. And a failure of European leaders to demonstrate the importance of a united Europe is a contributing factor, I think, to that. And the austerity policies obviously have contributed to the anti-EU sentiment. So these things are all really linked, and together they contribute to what we've seen as a rise in these hate parties in many countries.
So I'm very disturbed by the rise of these parties, and you're absolutely right that things have gotten worse as the recession has deepened and as your skepticism has risen. But I wanted to push you on this question of whether the right strategy is to exclude these parties, say that they are beyond the pale, or instead whether there's an alternative strategy that could work, which is to try to bring them and their leaders into the mainstream. Whether the Dutch choice of bringing far-right parties led by Haider into government then destroyed those parties, or the Dutch choice, Pim Fortuyn, bringing that party into government basically moved it from a party that was an opposition party into a party of government that had to moderate its demand and lost a lot of its support in the process. Mm-hmm. Is there another strategy other than inclusion, than exclusion?
Yeah, I mean, it's a good point. I would say, first of all, that I don't think there's a one-size-fits-all answer to that. We're talking somewhat in generalities here, and we won't have time to get deep into the specifics of each situation in these parties. But I do think when I say that they need to be challenged, I do want to be clear that, we at least, Human Rights First, I am not talking about outlawing them or banning their speech. And that's a really important point because not only do I think that that can, violate some fundamental human rights principles, but also it tends to backfire. It's in Europe. I often confront. The Europeans are generally much more. They find it much more acceptable to, as a response to just outlaw speech, ideas, and hate, or at least to try to do that. As Americans, we have a much stronger attachment to the values of free speech and combating hate speech with more speech as opposed to banning it. So I think that's a really important point. But because, I think underlying your question, though, is that these parties exist not in isolation, but in a political ecosystem, and not just a political ecosystem, but really, a societal system that in which there are a lot of contributing factors. And so there are different strategies to take the wind out of or the popularity out of some of these far-right parties. And in some instances, I think co-option may be helpful. But, you also have sort of the opposite. It can have the opposite effect. And that is one of the things that we've seen in Hungary is, in order to maintain the ruling party, Fidesz, and the Prime Minister Viktor Orban, in order to, he has, instead of, rejecting the Jobbik, which is the name of the far-right party in Hungary, has really co-opted much of their agenda. Jobbik has pushed the ruling party to the right. And mainstreamed the party in not so much in co-opting them and making them part of the government, but really has in some ways mainstreamed their hateful ideas. So that's a problem. But I think the bottom line is that challenging the underpinnings, the hateful underpinnings, that has to be the job both of civil society and of the ruling governments.
Can you talk a little bit more about what concerns you most? You've mentioned two countries, Hungary and Greece, and two extreme right parties. What are the countries, the incidents, the trends that are worrying you most?
Yeah, I mean, one of the reasons that that I wanted to come and talk about this, is that, I Human Rights First took up the this issue quite a long time ago, actually. We started looking at the rise of anti-Semitic hate crime in particular about 10 years ago in Europe, and we believed that European governments were not paying close enough attention to it, and also were not really even keeping accurate statistics about it. So many European governments in, you know, the early 2000s were dismissing anti-Semitic hate crime, including violent crime, as hooliganism, or, you know, weren't classifying it and didn't really, and then at the same time were saying that they didn't have a problem with anti-Semitism in their countries. And so the first step was to try to get them to document that. So we spent a fair amount of time trying to get, at that point, it was 56 countries that form the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe to adopt more rigorous standards for data collection. You know, you can't really fix a problem. And, you know, people say the first step towards, towards change is admitting you have a problem. And Europe was not admitting that it had any problem. So we had a kind of odd campaign where we went to the meeting of the OSCE in 2004 and had buttons and everything that said data. It was all about data, and trying to get these governments to agree to keep data, at least, on anti-Semitic and other hate-motivated violence. And we succeeded in getting these requirements at the OSCE, but along with the Anti-Defamation League, we now publish a report, a kind of a report card on these countries every year, and it's pretty dismal. I mean, there are very, very few countries get above a C in terms of fulfilling their commitments just to collect data. So we published a series of reports. We came up with a 10-point plan for governments to, to tackle these crimes, and tried to promote that over the last 10 years. We had the 10-year anniversary of that gathering in Berlin last fall, with the OSCE looking at a situation in which the violence had actually gotten worse. And we pressed for, as I said, Human Rights First is an American organization. So you might ask, you know, what are we doing messing around in Europe? We have our own problems, they have their problems. But as an organization that works on global human rights challenges through the lens of American leadership, we know that how important it is to have a strong relationship between Europe and the United States. And what we felt we were seeing was the erosion of democratic values in Europe, the weakening of the EU from the inside, and, you know, we can talk later about the role of Russia in that, in fomenting that or pressing for it and funding it in some instances. And so we wanted to make the case that this is something Americans should care about, and not just Americans who happen to be Jewish, but all Americans need to care about this. And we think it's exceedingly important for this to be seen not as a Jewish issue, but as a human rights issue. And that's in large part why Human Rights First, an organization that focuses on a wide range of human rights challenges, decided to take this up in the first place. I was really struck, I'll just say one quick anecdote. When I was in Berlin last fall for this meeting of the OSCE, thankfully the U.S. government was represented at a very high level. We pressed to get a cabinet official to come and lead the delegation, and that happened. That was not the case with the other government delegations. But I was really struck by the civil society groups that gathered for that meeting. The United States civil society representatives really looked like a cross-section of American society. You know, there were Jews, Muslims, Sikhs, you know, African Americans, civil rights leaders, people like me, just a wide range of religious groups represented. And I realized as I was speaking on my panel in a working group about security at Jewish institutions that the civil society groups from the other countries were all from Jewish organizations, not broader civil society. And that's really a big part of the problem. And so one of the things that we have on our agenda that we'd like to try to get the United States government to do is to foster greater concern in European societies across civil society organizations. It's something Human Rights First is going to try to do, so that when we get together next time, you know, the civil society delegations from these other countries reflect a broader concern around these issues, people joining together, creating stronger communities of tolerance. Without that, I think, you know, that's an essential component of an overall strategy to combat this this rise of hate-motivated violence.
Could you talk a little bit further about how the problems are linked, how the anti-Muslim attacks are linked to the anti-Jewish attacks, and also about how to bring together bodies that see themselves as distinct, whether new equality bodies in Europe, whether new ombudsmen, new human rights, national human rights institutions are helpful in reconceptualizing the problem as a human rights problem rather than as a problem targeting particular minority groups?
Yes. Well, I mean, one thing that we learned over the last decade of working on these issues is that hate doesn't stay in these neat little boxes. You know, if there's an enabling environment for hate, it also, you know, if when you have an enabling environment for hate crime against Jews, it also tends to be the case that there are hate crimes against immigrants, against the LGBT, members of the LGBT community. And so getting civil society groups to understand that and then providing them the venues to be able to band together is really, really important. You know, the flip side, the kind of dark side of there's also a terrible symbiotic relationship between these kind of more classical, if you will, strange, horrible way of thinking about it, but more traditional hate groups, neo-Nazi, fascist groups, anti-Semitic groups, the relationship between those and Muslim extremist groups. Particularly in France, for example, you know, after the attacks on Charlie Hebdo and the kosher supermarket, there was so much focus on the Muslim extremist groups. And we also were wanting to talk about how this back and forth reaction between the far right, they feed on each other, really. You know, so you have the far right pushing policies that further marginalize immigrants, and you have extremist groups, Islamic extremist groups, violent individuals using that as a way to foment more violence from their side. And that kind of destructive cycle can get out of control very, very quickly. And so that's one of the things that you need, you know, some of the examples, there are positive examples in Europe of people banding together, whether it's the Ring of Peace in, you know, around the synagogue in Copenhagen, that was an interfaith, an explicitly interfaith exercise to protect the synagogue there that had been attacked, or other kinds of efforts that you see in Sweden and other countries. Those are the places where we look for hope. And I met some of these young interfaith leaders in Berlin, and it was the most hopeful thing that I had experienced in all of this craziness. You know, we did this report, which you can get on our website last year. It's called "We're Not Nazis, But," which is the beginning of a quote from the Jobbik Party in Hungary. The report focuses on Hungary and Greece, where most of the violence was happening, particularly last year. And it's such a terribly depressing report. And the violence is so extreme and hateful. And the resonance that it was getting in the political environments in these countries is really quite disturbing. But the flip side is that you see some real, you know, particularly among youth leaders, pushing back against that and saying this is not the kind of societies that we want to live in. And whatever we can be doing as civil society, but also with the U.S. government, to ensure that those efforts are well-funded and have resonance and are lifted up in some way, I think can be really, really helpful.
So before opening to questions from the audience, I wanted to ask you a question along somewhat different lines. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to ask you to tell me how you think, not in your role as an advocate, but in your role as a CEO and leader of an organization, how do you assess whether your advocacy efforts are bringing about the desired effects? I know that a lot of NGOs that provide aid are now being asked what proportion of the money mm-hmm. reaches recipients, how much do these recipients' lives change? What metrics do you use when you're an advocacy body?
So I don't know how much any of you will be interested in that, but as the CEO of an advocacy organization, I actually spend a lot of time thinking about that effectiveness. How do we measure, you know, our own effectiveness? And I actually teach a class every now and then at Georgetown Law School that is on human rights advocacy, and it's really all about, you know, how do you effectively advocate, and how do you tell whether you're being effective and that kind of thing. So I have thought about this a little bit. And I think that it really begins with identifying a real concrete outcome, as is probably true in whatever realm any of you are working in. You know, if you don't know where you're going, then you're going to have a hard time getting there or knowing whether you ever got there. You know, we go through a fairly rigorous exercise at Human Rights First where we really spend a lot of time thinking about what is the outcome that we are really aiming for, and is it stated in such a way that we will know whether we succeeded or failed. And, you know, a lot of people say, well, in policy and this kind of thing, you can't really quantify, maybe not numbers, but you certainly can in outcomes. And we have a pretty good sense of you know, policy change that we are trying to make happen. And if you can spell that out with some specificity, then you can figure out what kind of strategy you would need to get there. And then, you know, we every 6 months or so assess whether or not our strategies are working. Did the environment change in some way that makes that, you know, not an effective strategy anymore? And, you know, are we winning? Are we losing? A lot of the stuff, you know, obviously these problems, this one and many of the human rights challenges that the world faces and that Human Rights First tries to tackle are big and intractable or seemingly intractable, and you can get kind of overwhelmed by them. But breaking them down into smaller parts and figuring out, you know, what is the next turning point? It's what you mentioned, the torture work that we did, for example, and I'll just say one more word on that and then we can have more questions. But, you know, when the United States was engaging in an actual policy of abuse of prisoners, you know, after 9/11, and human rights groups and a lot of Americans were crying foul and saying, how could we, and all that, and many other Americans were saying, we just don't want to hear about it, just keep us safe. You know, we asked ourselves what would be the next turning point? What needed to happen in order to start to change that policy? And one of the things was challenging this idea of the efficacy of torture, of the, you know, the claims that were being made about that torture was necessary and that it worked and saved American lives. And that's, you know, Senator Feinstein really was a leader in doing an investigation of that program and then pushing really hard. We set as the goal for ourselves, Human Rights First, getting declassification of the study that the Senate Intelligence Committee did on the CIA interrogation program, getting that declassified and released to the public. And so that's the kind of outcome that you can tell whether you win or lose. And we got that, largely we got that released in December. And so now we're on to the next challenge. But that's how we do it, and I'd love to talk about anything that you guys are interested about, that and other. other issues?
Well, we certainly have a lot of questions from the audience already. So I'll start with a question that focuses on recent events in the Mediterranean. The question asks about the flow of North African migrants to Europe and how it has impacted or exacerbated the problem of extremism and xenophobia. And there's a second part. What are your predictions about how Europe will address this new migration challenge?
Right, right. Well, it's a really important question, and it's obviously very tied up in both the there was a pre-existing condition in Europe before this most recent, migration across the Mediterranean, all the terrible situation of people. It certainly seems to be a mixed migration, lots of different nationalities, lots of people. I mean, we're in a situation right now, let me just step back. You know, the pre-existing condition in Europe was this sense of, a failure to adequately integrate immigrants and other minorities into society, sense of marginalization there, which exacerbated the sense of injustice, and as we have already discussed, fed into, makes it easier to recruit people to a more extremist view. And the far right parties that we've been talking about have really, tried to push the mainstream parties into what they, call a tougher stand on immigration. In a lot of cases, unfortunately, the mainstream parties didn't need much of a push. But, obviously the economic situation has made it much more difficult for the ruling parties to deal with immigration in a humane way. And all of that is happening at a time, when, because of the war in Syria and lots of other crises, right now there are more migrants and refugees than any time since World War II. I mean, it is a massive global crisis. And the global system of refugee protection that was developed mostly after World War II is falling apart, and Western nations are not doing what they've committed to do, and obviously Europe is a destination for a lot of these people. And now, there are countries in Europe that have done an awful lot and have done a pretty good job. I mean, Italy has certainly taken in a lot. But the overall response has not been great. And there have been, I think, nearly 2,000 people who have died now, in trying to make the, across the Mediterranean from Libya and wherever. And the EU has not been able really to come up with a comprehensive response to that. What they have done is say they're going to, launch an effort to, go after the smuggler ships leaving Libya and, try to keep people from getting on those ships. Obviously, that can save some lives, but it's not going to really help people who, people who are desperate, who are fleeing persecution and threat. Imagine yourself in that situation. You'll do whatever you can do. And people find a way. The one thing I think the EU is considering is upping its, numbers of refugees that it would resettle, which is obviously really important. But the numbers they're talking about, around 20,000 extra slots, it's kind of a drop in the bucket. But certainly it's a step in the right direction, and we would welcome that. But there need to be legal routes for migration. And countries have never been very good at that. If there were better legal routes for migration, you would have you would have a disincentive for people to use smugglers. That's true on our southern border too. When our immigration system breaks down, you have people who are put in more vulnerable situations. They pay coyotes and other traffickers to get across the border, and that adds to the danger. The U.S. certainly has a strategic and a moral interest in making sure that just to bring it back to what the United States can do. But it also, as I said earlier, a big part of what we do is try to make sure that the U.S. can lead by example. And, you know, so we need to make sure we have our own house in order, too, in what we're doing. I mean, another big project that Human Rights First is working on is dealing with this terrible situation of, you know, the fact that our government is detaining women and children in facilities in Texas, jail-like in many instances, facilities in Texas, many of whom, the majority of whom, according to UNHCR, have claims to refugee status here. And it's cruel and expensive and unnecessary. So we need to be, you know, at the same time. I'm not one of those people who says, you know, let whoever among you is without sin cast the first. I do think we need to be speaking out. The United States, imperfect as it is, has been a global leader in establishing these norms and should be advocating for them. But we also have to do that with some humility, knowing that we have a lot of work to do on our own.
So one of our questions from human rights attorney Mihail Sorgin focuses directly on what's happening on the home front, and he asks, is anti-immigrant sentiment growing here in the U.S.? Why or why not?
Well, you know, that we could have a whole a whole separate session on that. You know, the history of our country is one that's been very conflicted about immigration almost from the very beginning. You know, my grandparents came over from Italy to try to find a better life and found, you know, initially a lot of discrimination. We have, you know, the Statue of Liberty in our history, and we have the Chinese exclusion laws. We have, you know, I'm not sure if I would say cyclical, but we've certainly, you know, have a checkered history, and some of those are, you know, some great periods and some not so great. But I think, you know, we have a very strong national consensus right now that our current immigration system does not work. It doesn't work well for our economy. It doesn't work well for our values. It's broken in many respects. And I was part of a Council on Foreign Relations task force some years ago on immigration, and it was very politically diverse and diverse in many ways. It had, you know, people like me. It had people from the Homeland Security Department. It was actually co-chaired by Jeb Bush and Mac McLarty, a former Clinton administration official, and it was amazing to me how quickly consensus was reached in that group. About you know, how we were not getting it right on immigration, and there were recommendations to move forward to make our immigration policy work better for our economy, for businesses, and also for our values and to protect refugees. And you know, here we are, however many, you know, 7 years after that or 9 years after that task force, and still seem to be stuck. And part of it is our political environment is very, seems incapable of solving big problems despite strong consensus. I think that there is a quiet consensus in this country that we need to fix our immigration laws and make them, you know, more humane. We have stepped up a lot of enforcement, but you mean to more directly to the question about, you know, are we anti-immigrant here? It was really, I mean, there is something profoundly wrong when, you know, when this country, which, you know, was founded by refugees and has so much wealth also, you know, could react so harshly to children who were fleeing terrible violence in some of the most, you know, dangerous countries on earth in Central America, and to treat them like criminals. I mean, that's just was a new low, I think, for us, and we need to change that. But I, you know, maybe it's an occupational hazard, but I tend to see the glass a little bit more half full, because I talk to a lot of people around the country about this issue, and I find more consensus than not that we should be living our values, that we should care about refugees, that immigrants bring vitality to our country, and we just have to have a system that makes more sense and that has rules that work, and we don't have that right now.
Thank you. I've received a couple of questions about anti-Semitism in Europe, so I thought I'd ask the more provocative one.
Okay.
Well, what do you think of President Netanyahu's suggestion that European Jews should leave Israel and leave Europe and move to Israel?
Well, I find it a profoundly depressing suggestion, and I think in many ways conceding defeat and I think it's a horrible idea, but obviously it's not. I'm not Jewish. If I were a Jew living in Europe, I have a family. I would be thinking the same thing. And many Jews are. It's horrifying to see. I don't know how many of you saw the global poll that the Anti-Defamation League did last, I think it was last year, on global attitudes towards Jews. And it was really, I mean, some people questioned the methodology. I'm not a pollster. I don't really know how. But it was really frightening to see the levels of animosity. And you combine that with the spike in violence in Europe. And I think, what it says to me, that suggestion, what it says to me is that we really have to redouble our efforts, because it would be really disastrous, not just for Europe, but also for the spread of democratic values globally, to concede defeat in that way.
Thank you. I've received a couple of questions about current conditions. One is about the role of economic factors in the rise of the far right, and the other is about the role of technology, not only in facilitating, but also perhaps in combating the rise of extremism and xenophobia.
Right. So, well, clearly economic factors are highly relevant to this phenomenon, and as I said, I think that they are an element of the environment that enables pre-existing hate parties and hate people who foment this kind of hatred to gain traction when there's a sense of hopelessness on both the sides of the phenomenon that I mentioned, the kind of nationalist far right and also some of these Islamic extremist groups, the economic factors are huge. I don't have a grand solution for that, obviously, but it certainly plays into it. But also, I really want to underscore that it's not inevitable that poor economic conditions produce this kind of rise in hate violence. It's just hasn't borne out. There are other countries that also have suffered under the economic collapse in Europe that have not shown this kind of. I mean, in Italy, actually, the hate parties, the support for the hate far right parties went down, even despite the poor economic conditions. So it's obviously a factor, but it's not a determinative factor. On technology, the question really answers itself. I mean, it's a double-edged sword. You don't have to spend too much time on Twitter to see rampant hatred for almost any group that you can, women, Jews, Muslim, everyone. So a lot of people question whether is that a net plus for society, having the ability to express, in some cases anonymously, this kind of virulent bigotry and hatred. It's disgusting. You get lost in that, you can lose your faith in humanity pretty quickly. But we do know that at the same time, a lot of the young people who are trying to combat this horrible scourge are using social media to connect and to do so. You know, it gets back to, you know, the kind of divide between Europe and the United States and how you deal with speech online. And, you know, the technology companies obviously have a very strong view about this. I also tend to err on the side of, you know, more speech is better, and we have, but when you've got new avenues for speech, including for hate speech like this, what it requires is a massive stepping up and smarter strategies for combating that in exact same venues. We can't sit back and be dismissive of that kind of, you have to engage, and that requires a lot of vigilance, and it really, on the part of political leaders and also on all of us. I mean, that's one of the things that everybody can do, is to be constantly challenging, not to let this kind of speech go unchallenged, and to press our political leaders to challenge it. And, you know, so many of them are not good at that. But when they get pushed by their constituents, they get better.
I also have some questions about European history. So one question is about how anti-Semitism should be fought differently in countries that experienced the Holocaust from countries that did not. Another question is about a history of colonialism, mm-hmm. and how we might think about anti-racism in France, given its relationships with North Africa and other colonies versus in other countries.
Mm-hmm. Wow, those are really interesting questions. And you, Katerina, might have some thoughts on them as well, given your expertise. Okay, so the first part of it was?
The first part is anti-Semitism in countries
that have experienced
the Holocaust.
Yes, yeah.
As opposed to other
countries. Wow, so even amongst that subset, you know, there are some differences. So it's not a one-size-fits-all even amongst that subset. I mean, one of the things we saw taking a deeper dive looking at the situation in Hungary was, you know, one of the features of the rise of these parties is a drift towards kind of historic revisionism about the Holocaust. You know, in Hungary, what you saw was a really, I mean, it crystallized around actually a what was supposed to be a memorial to victims of the Holocaust, but it ended up being protested by some survivors. Because it recast the role of Hungary as a complete victim, when that, you know, is not historically correct, that there was complicity there, and as there was in some other countries. And you know, so I think one of the risks that we have to be attentive to in countries that had some experience, you know, directly involved, both as victim and either bystander or perpetrator during the Holocaust, is to guard against revisionist history. And there is that's a feature that you see throughout. You know, it was horribly true in Greece, for sure. I mean, Greece, that, you know, suffered so much in World War II, and yet, you know, has this bizarre strain of political thought talking about, you know, complete Holocaust denial, and also using Holocaust, you know, kind of imagery and that to direct hatred against groups that had nothing to do with the Holocaust. So saying, you know, you have the Golden Dawn Party in Greece, senior members of which are now on trial. You know, it took, just as an aside, I want to say that, you know, Golden Dawn is the neo-Nazi party in Greece that was gaining in popularity and in fact, I think, infiltrating some of organs of the state. And the before the recent election, the previous government in Greece really took a very long time to do anything about it. You know, there was violence against immigrants. There was mostly immigrants from Africa. And it wasn't until the Golden Dawn operatives murdered a popular Greek rap singer that the government finally went into action and indicted some senior members, including some sitting members of parliament. And now those people are on trial in Greece. We're watching that trial very closely, by the way, and we want Americans to understand what's going on there and other European countries as well. And we hope that there'll be a fair trial there and that it can be used as an example. But I'm not sure that I'm qualified to, because I'm not an expert in European history, but obviously the second part of this question, the complicated nature in particular of France and France's history as a colonial power, and the historical resentments that are there, and the sometimes latent, sometimes not so latent racism in French society is obviously a factor. And so we, Human Rights First tries to be very attentive to the differences in these societies where this phenomenon is taking place. Even in this report that we did last year on Hungary and Greece, obviously there are, huge differences between those two countries. But there are also some strains of similarity. And, when we're looking for how to craft solutions to this problem, and in particular what the United States can be doing, we want to look at, the thematic similarities there so we can craft a broader policy. But it's going to have to be different for different countries. And I'm sure that this issue of colonialism, historical colonialism, is relevant not just in France but in some other countries where this is
Could you elaborate a little bit on that? So when you get pushback that you don't understand the particular country's history, that American history of slavery taints everything Americans say today, what do you answer? What is the added value of an American advocacy body when European civil society in many of these countries is very vibrant and alternative options for pursuing extremism are on the table?
Yeah, well, I guess, as I said before, our focus, Human Rights First, we're not so much directly advocating with European governments. We're really looking to what should the United States' role be in this. And we're trying to make the case that the U.S. has a stake in the outcome of what's going on in Europe right now, particularly around these hate parties. And we want our government to be paying closer attention to this and to be taking it seriously. And who better to make that happen than groups based here in the United States? So that's why we're doing it. It's true that there is a vibrant civil society in many European countries, but there are two problems that we saw. One is the one I described in my experience at this meeting on anti-Semitism in Berlin last fall, and that is that while there may be a vibrant civil society in many of these countries, they are not taking this seriously as a human rights issue, many of them. They weren't there. And I think that's a problem, and we need to, we can help to change that. So I think that the United States, and not just the U.S. government, but also civil society in the United States, can provide an excellent example of the benefits of solidarity and the necessity of solidarity. That's what happened in this country, again, in the civil rights movement. And, that's how we say this with great humility, but also, frankly, with a little bit of pride, that this is how we have been able to make progress here. Yes, we have also the legacy of slavery in this country, certainly periods of discrimination, xenophobia, racism against pretty much every minority group throughout our history. But that should not silence us. It should just give us, humility, but also it means we have great experience. I mean, one of the things that really that the United States has to offer for Europe because of our history, we've actually developed very strong measures to combat hate crime, to prosecute hate crime, You know, the United States can be sharing that expertise, the FBI, the Justice Department, with other governments. You know, in order to tackle these, you have to have a strong relationship between civil society, including groups, victim communities, and law enforcement. That is not the case in a lot of these countries, where the victim communities are very isolated. You know, in a lot of countries, you have Jewish communities that have to, you know, find themselves having to fund their own security. You know, that should not be. And so one of the things that we're pressing our own government to do is to be, you know, sharing its expertise on the prosecution, investigation of hate crime, and on building relationships with civil society groups that care about these issues.
Great. So we're coming to the end of the hour, but I wanted to ask you one last but very important question. For people committed to the goals you are pursuing, what are the best ways to help? You talked earlier on about partnerships between private law firms that you're tapping into where lawyers are offering pro bono hours. I imagine people can give money. I imagine the government can change its policies through the way we pursue trade or aid or sanctions. What are the specific tools you would
all
like
of those things are good.
Members of the audience, our government, and other Americans to take to help pursue these goals?
Well, it starts with coming to discussions like this and caring, and that's very encouraging. So that's the beginning of it. Of course, taking responsibility to educate yourself about these issues. We are blessed to live in a country where we have representative government, and sometimes it functions better than other times, but we have, you know, people who are charged with representing us in government, and they need to know how we feel about these issues. So communicating with them is extremely important. Making sure that our elected representatives understand that as Americans, we think this is a priority. That's really important. Obviously, you know, supporting groups that are working on this, that's also great. And we would love to have, you know, your support for Human Rights First and other organizations that are trying to tackle these issues, and volunteering your time. But, you know, regardless of all of that, committing to yourself that not to be silent in environments where you witness or hear hatred being expressed is a really important personal commitment. And it's harder than people think to commit to that. But that is really where it starts. Without that, you know, you don't get much done. But with that, you know, you can get almost anything done.
Actually, I have time for one more question.
Okay.
So I'm very pleased. because a lot of conversations about human rights and extremism and the rise of the extreme right are incredibly depressing. A lot of conversations about violence and hate leave us feeling powerless. I want to hear a little bit more about the success stories. You talked about Guantanamo and torture and how our government has changed its policies. Where else have you seen clear change as a result of advocacy, or where mm-hmm. else do you foresee good news in uh-huh. the near future? I have a question about the future of the EU, and I bet those news will be bad, so I didn't want to ask about that. So I'm asking for where do you see, you said you see the glass as half empty often, and I wanted to hear a little bit more about that.
Okay. You mentioned the UN, which it's often bad news around that. But I will say that, you know, earlier this year, the UN General Assembly had the very first session ever to address the problem of anti-Semitism. We pushed very hard for that. It happened. I was privileged to be able to speak at that meeting. And it was a very important meeting. There were representatives from a lot of governments, including in the Middle East, where anti-Semitism is official government policy. And They attended many of them, and they were there, you know, and they had to listen to it. I mean, they didn't have to be there, but they were there, and they heard it, including powerful remarks from the rabbi, who was the father in Toulouse, who was the whose child was brutally murdered at her school in an anti-Semitic hate crime. So it was really important. I don't, you know, have any illusions about the effectiveness of the UN on a lot of these issues, but even in a place like that, we were able to move the needle a little bit. But there are lots of other places, and you know, I don't know how much time we have, but I mentioned the one, you know, turning the tables on the torture debate, which we're still, obviously, these problems don't get completely solved, or they don't stay solved. You have to keep working on them. But one of the most rewarding things that I've ever done in my career, about 25 years of working on these issues, was after the Abu Ghraib scandal and the pictures that came out, and which then opened up, we learned over years, much more of the horrible things that our own government was doing to prisoners in its custody. We decided to convene a group of retired generals and admirals and ask them what they thought about that. And we gathered in a room in a private meeting, not knowing what their answer was going to be. And we walked out of that room with a coalition of four-star generals who decided to devote their retirement to upholding American ideals. And they are still working with us to do that more than 10 years later. And it's been a huge inspiration in my life and in my career to have the solidarity of what some people call unlikely allies walking hand in hand with us to make sure that our beloved country upholds its most cherished ideals. It's really encouraging. And there's a lot of other things too, but we're probably out of time to deal with them. But
yes, thank you all for coming here tonight. Thank you very much for your thought-provoking questions. And please join me in a round of applause for our speaker tonight, Elisa Massimino.
Thanks. Thanks very much.